You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Here on Idaho Matters, we have talked about prisoner labor, from prisoners helping to fight wildfires in our state to female prisoners at the South Boise Women's Correctional Center who collaborate with the Idaho Humane Society to foster sick cats and kittens until they can be rehomed. And you might not know that prisoners also work on farms. Coming up in our next segment, we will talk with a representative from the Idaho Correctional Industries. But first, we want to give you a bit of history around the practice of prison labor across our country. Joining us live on the phone from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, is Professor Steon Rice. He wrote the article for The Conversation called Farmers Turn to Prisons to Fill Labor Needs. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Gemma.
So, Dr. Rice, let's just start with your article, because you really do take a critical look at the concept that's called convict leasing. So can you just start with explaining what exactly that term means?
Sure. Well, convict leasing is a system in which states lease prison inmates to private companies to supply labor. And that labor can be used to make anything from clothes and furniture to light manufacturing and even agriculture. It became notorious after the Civil War, when it was responsible for rather terrible working conditions and brutality, particularly against Black inmates in the southern U.S. So during Reconstruction and Jim Crow, southern states established Black codes and other measures that selectively incarcerated newly freed slaves. So the states would then lease these inmates to private businesses, including former plantations, at extremely low wage rates. And as you might imagine, this brought considerable profits to both private growers and the state. In fact, it's estimated that in some southern states, the revenues generated by leasing were four times greater than the cost of running the prisons. It didn't last very long. It actually went away, and that's because leasing convicts at a cut rate essentially suppresses the wages of poor free workers.
Okay.
So
that's the thing. So then take us into the 20th century with the Great Depression, because I would think that this would potentially have kind of a snowball effect then when we're talking wages and the Great Depression, yes?
Absolutely, right. So you have rampant unemployment, and the government began to pass laws that made it illegal for states to then lease prisoners, because prison labor was seen as a threat to the free labor market. So not only could they not lease prisoners, but prisons couldn't sell the goods that were produced by prisoners on the open market. So that situation holds sway from the Great Depression up until about the late 1970s, when convict leasing begins to return. But it doesn't return in agriculture, and this is kind of the key point. By the 1980s and through 2000s, farm work is being done primarily by migrant laborers. So agriculture has found, you know, another population that is willing to work for low wages here. And then if we fast forward to today, with current anti-immigrant policies, you know, that are cutting into the supply of migrant workers, growers are once again desperate for labor. And the solution that several states have been rolling out is to return convicts to the farm under these leasing contracts.
So were this so was this convict leasing ever officially banned in the United States, or did it go out of practice and then slowly ramp up again?
It was officially banned under the Asher-Sumner's Act in the 1930s, but the prohibitions were gradually relaxed in the 1970s through the 1980s, and there's a program, the PIECP program, that tried to establish, in fact, encourage states to begin the leasing process in industries other than agriculture.
So let's talk about agriculture, though, because this is, as you said, we're starting to see this again. And do you believe there is a danger in using prison labor in agriculture?
I think there are kind of four concerns. The first is that there's the potential for the abuse of a captive population, one that, you know, has rather little political voice. That's not to say that it is guaranteed to happen, but there's plenty of historical precedent for labor abuses, both on the prison side and on the agriculture side. And now we're combining the two. The second, there are economic concerns. You know, while it can be lucrative for states and for growers, having low leasing rates also serves as a kind of subsidy. And this can lead to distortions in the labor market or unfair business practices, kind of what happened during the Great Depression and the pushback against leasing. So, for instance, Washington State ran into this several years ago in other prison industries where companies that were leasing inmates were ruled by the courts to have an unfair advantage. The third is that, you know, leasing reduces the economic motivation to properly address our migrant worker situation. So part of the pressure to resolve our immigration policies is coming from growers who need workers. And that pressure is important. And so by leasing inmates to growers, we run the risk of kind of kicking the can down the road, so to speak. And then the last one is that agricultural labor is still onerous and dangerous work. So as far as improving working conditions for laborers, leasing has a, you know, it has a kind of opportunity cost. In other words, we miss an opportunity here for positive change. So long as agriculture can find a vulnerable population to use, then there's less incentive to improve wages or working conditions. And prisoners do not have constitutional rights to organize or unionize for better conditions. So we're only going to get that change if there's public pressure.
We're talking with Steon Rice. He is a professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We're talking about his article regarding prisoners working on farms. You can actually also find that article in the High Country News if you are interested in reading the entire article. So, Dr. Rice, very good points that you just made. And also, one of your areas of academic research is food crisis. So, A, within your research, do you believe that we are seeing a crisis today when it comes to agriculture and in food? And if so, is it prices? Is it labor? Is it both?
It's an interesting question. You're right. One of the areas that I look at is how the changes, the slow-moving changes that take place within food systems, how they kind of produce and perpetuate spaces of unequal access. Sometimes they lead to, you know, sudden acute crises, but sometimes there's kind of a situation of, you know, grinding hunger or malnutrition in particular areas. So this is, you know, what we think of as inner city food deserts or what are now being called food apartheids. But in examining urban food inequality, one of the big questions is what's the role of labor? So, you know, wage earning labor has the potential to benefit the food system by through purchases or even through working on urban farms and these kinds of productive activities. But we find within the inner city that there is a loss of labor. And so then where is that labor going and what is it doing? Well, today it's increasingly being put to work in agriculture in rural areas through the prison system. So that's kind of how I got into the subject was by tracing this causal labor connection.
You know, in a little bit, we're going to be talking with the Idaho Correctional Industries about the claim that inmates are harvesting fruit for farmers who might actually lose their fruit trees, and that what we're talking in particular here in Idaho. And part of that reasoning is the claim that unemployment is so low here in our state, so that can be a struggle to find workers. But in your opinion, A, is there a benefit to that? But B, does this also potentially go back to your, you know, those four potential issues that you said could happen, and one of them being not addressing our migrant issue?
Right. In a sense, because, you know, if you look at the long history of agriculture, because the system is able to shift its focus from one vulnerable population to another, it's able to avoid having to address issues of paying a reasonable wage or addressing regulatory issues like exposure to, you know, to toxic chemicals and things like that. And I, you know, when we talk about the unemployment being very low, well, the way an ordinary labor market would respond would be by increasing the wages so that you start to attract workers to that industry. But so long as there are ways to get free or very cheap labor, then you don't have to address that. And I think that's kind of the idea behind this opportunity cost. And, you know, it may very well be that our immigration policy change and we go back to having migrant workers take on these roles. But it is, at least for now, the use of prison labor has the potential to materially realize these anti-immigrant policies.
And that potentially goes back to this whole idea of putting restrictions on immigrants nationally and how it could potentially, you know, it has a domino effect in a way, right? All the way down to agriculture, to farmers, mom and pop farmers needing workers that they potentially cannot get.
Absolutely. And there's, you know, one other feature is that it's not just about the prices that farmers set for wages. The specialty crop sector is the least subsidized sector, least subsidized major sector in agriculture. We essentially do not subsidize vegetable production, and we only barely subsidize some fruit production. So as a result, the cost to produce a pound of vegetables, there's a significant portion of that cost that is borne by labor. It's a labor-intensive crop. So what that means then is by putting workers for very low wages into the system, the government is essentially subsidizing that market. But there are other ways that they could subsidize it that would allow us to improve working conditions and wages for workers.
I want to thank you for talking with us today about this and giving us that background. Our guest today, Dr. Steon Rice, he is a professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We've been talking about his article regarding prisoners working on farms. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day. Do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And up next, another view about this issue, prison labor, from the Division Chief of Idaho Correctional Industries. How does the program work and who does it benefit? I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. We just heard from a professor about the history and the practice of prison labor here in the United States. Well, now we want to find out more about how this practice is used here in Idaho. Joining us live in studio is Kevin Mickelson. He is the Division Chief of Idaho Correctional Industries. Kevin manages the use of inmate labor here in our state. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me, Jenna.
So your group, Idaho Correctional Industries, you describe yourselves, and this is a quote, as a self-funded government agency, and you do not receive taxpayer dollars. So let's just start right there, and how exactly are you funded?
We're funded through sales of products that we create. Most of our programs are inside the fence. We refer to them as the traditional programs. We make furniture, prints, sign. Our market that we sell this to are government agencies and nonprofits. Mm-hmm. We are created in 1974 by the legislature. We just had our 45th birthday on last Monday. So our whole mission is to help incarcerated individuals have training in job skills and life skills so that they are successful upon release.
So are some of these programs the programs that we all kind of hear about with work that's done within the prison, as you said, like building furniture? This is not something that they necessarily have to go off-site and do, correct?
Correct. We have 23 apprenticeship programs that are certified with the Department of Labor. And that's our basis of what we do, the traditional programs. So a apprenticeship could, essentially our practical, it's based on the number of hours working in that position. So we have them from anywhere from 2,000 hours up to 8,000 hours.
And so as you said, that's an apprenticeship. So when they are released, can they then take that apprenticeship and go out into the workforce?
That's correct. If they don't complete the apprenticeship while they're still in the ICI training program, all those hours will transfer out and they can take the hours that they've gained to their future employer or into a training program, and that'll all still be counted toward their apprenticeship.
So let's talk about agriculture then, and particularly in the private sector, because the conversation, the last segment, was really based around, you know, the history and the practice of prisoners being used in agriculture, farm labor. So who decides which farms the prisoners will work at?
Well, generally what happens is that one of the private egg partners will come to us, and we go through a process to look at their facility to make sure that it's a safe facility to work in. Our security folks go and look at it to make sure that it will be a secure facility for our people to work at, and that means that it's not fenced in, but we can monitor all of the trainees while they're in the facility. They give us a list of the positions that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
We hand that list over to the Department of Labor, and the Department of Labor has an SOC code that's assigned, and each one of these codes are assigned a wage that's associated with that. And so once we go through the process, evaluating the company, evaluating the facility itself, if it meets our standards, then they can join our training program.
Have you seen a rise in a request for prisoners to work in agriculture and farm labor? And I ask that because, as you heard in our last segment, you know, we've had, you know, with certain policies in place federally when it comes to immigrants and migrant labor, there is a trickle-down effect of that all the way down to Idaho farmers.
Right. So not so much as a request for new facilities to come on board. Sometimes they request more staffing or more trainees in their program. Currently, we are limited to perishable food products. So that limits the number of private egg partners we can work with. Right now, we have about 300 trainees that are associated with this training program. We also have a limited number of incarcerated individuals who qualify for programs also.
Mm-hmm.
So the facilities that the trainees come from are our minimum security facilities. That would be St. Anthony's Work Camp and then Sickie here in the Valley, where the minimum security mm-hmm. folks are incarcerated.
You know, so the professor we just spoke with talked about one of his concerns being the safety of prisoners when it comes to doing agricultural work, farm labor in particular. So who trains these workers? I mean, I would assume a lot of them don't know how to work on a farm.
Right. And that's the basis of what we're doing, is that this is an actual training program. So when our trainees go into these facilities, we expect and we require that they go through the exact same training program that the free world workers are going through in that same facility. If you look at the average of our facilities, there might be 150 employees in a facility, and then we might have 20 of our trainees there. So they're not the majority of them. It's a smaller group, but they will go through the safety training. We expect them to be trained on all the equipment, move up through and learn all the different jobs throughout, with the hopes that they will be hired on after release.
We're talking with Kevin Mickelson. He's with Idaho Correctional Industries. This is the organization that actually manages prison labor through programs, some of them called Prison Industries Enhancement. So Kevin, what's interesting to me is I can understand going through an apprentice program, something like learning how to build furniture, you know, maybe an electrician, something like that, where there's an apprenticeship program and you can go out and make a living wage mm-hmm. once you are no longer incarcerated. I think that when we think of farm workers taking the place of migrant workers, even though your prisoners get paid, we hear story after story about how migrant workers are so underpaid for their work on farms. How can this translate then into a living wage for someone who is released from prison if they are working on farms? Does that make sense?
The wages that, I mean, we have a lot of agricultural workers in the state already who are, this is their career and this is their livelihood. And there's opportunity for more and more growth within that into the agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
We do need the workers here in the state. Hopefully we can train folks up to it. Not only just our folks aren't just the basic laborers that are there. They're learning how to operate the equipment. They have the opportunity to move up. If they work into a permanent job, they can become supervisors. Mm-hmm. Some of them are working as mechanics and machine operators in there. So there is a higher wage that's associated with that, especially long-term once they get out. Other industries here in the Valley, such as meat processing, have a pretty decent wage to go with it. And mm-hmm. we have a partner here in the Valley who has that we've been with for about 1 year, and they've hired 25 people out of our program onto their permanent payroll.
So you know, I think part of the concern that we heard from the professor in the last segment was also this idea that, you know, by law, inmates cannot, you know, form a union. They cannot, you know, say we're not being paid enough. They do not have those rights as prisoners. So this idea then that they could potentially be made to work, kind of like what happened during Reconstruction, as he talked about. Can you make a prisoner go and do this work?
Nope, we can't. All of our programs are voluntary. People apply to get into our programs, to join our training program and to go into any of these, whether it's in the agriculture or one of our traditional programs. There is not a forced labor from inmates in Idaho.
So if an inmate doesn't want to have a job, they don't have to have a job.
Nope.
And that is something because what I have read and researched is that a lot of these jobs are coveted.
They are coveted.
I mean, especially ones that have less restriction, which I would think when you talk about agriculture, mm-hmm. that especially like when we look at these lower level facilities, lower, you know, security facilities, you already have to be a certain type of inmate to qualify.
Correct, yeah. And so in the folks that are in our agricultural program, do they get out of the facility? They're working in the field, which we have very few that work in the field, but most of them are in factories. The wage that they receive is quite a bit higher than the traditional. We do have deductions for room and board, the security costs, transportation costs, and all that. That's the same as the free world workers are paying. They're paying their rent, and they're paying their transportation, and they're paying to take care of their children and all that. So it's a big benefit to them. And then especially when we get into the minimum security range where these folks are closer to release, it gives them the opportunity to start saving some money. That money mm-hmm. at release is very, very important so that they can have housing and they can have transportation. And hopefully through our training programs and the opportunities that we give them that they can find employment. And if they have employment, if they have transportation, they have housing, the chance for them to be successful is very, very high.
Have any of these prisoners who have worked in the agricultural sector left, been released, and been hired at any of these facilities that they were working
at? Oh, yes. Yeah, we have one here in the Valley who hired 25 people last year from out of the program. So they went to this facility, they were trained, worked up, and were hired onto the permanent payroll. A couple of them, their starting wage when they went permanent with it was around $18 an hour.
And this is full-time?
Full-time permanent, yep.
I want to thank you for coming in and telling us about the other side of this program. Our guest today, Kevin Mickelson of Idaho Correctional Industries. We've been talking about prisoner labor, in particular in the agricultural industry, particularly here in Idaho. Thank you again for the conversation.
Thank you.
Up next, we look at a Japanese star festival. I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters.